Hey folks, Rob Wolf here, episode 122
of the
Paleo Solution Podcast. I am super excited today. We have one of the smartest dudes in strength and conditioning, Joel Jamieson, author of 8 Weeks Out, the dude that founded the website 8 Weeks Out. If you have not checked that out and you care about your strength and conditioning at all, then you are dropping the ball. Joel, what's going on, man?
Not much. Just hanging out up in Seattle.
So, have you seen this thing called the sun before?
Every once in a while, it makes it, about July through August.
Nice. Right on. Hey, man, I have just been a huge fan of your work for a long, long time. Like, I absolutely love your book. I'm always hanging out on your website, kind of lurking on there. If folks aren't familiar with your background, can you give them a little bit of your story, like how you got into the strength and conditioning scene, how 8 Weeks Out came about, kind of how you've moved into this kind of combative strength and conditioning scene?
Sure, you know, I'd love to say it was all part of a master plan, but it's probably just more accident than anything else. And it's funny, I've been coming down as a conditioning guy, and you know, the guy I talked about energy systems, because really my background, especially in strength and conditioning, was in explosive power sports and football. I got my start over at the University of Washington with Seahawks, you know, predominantly working with football players, and strength and power athletes and conditioning wasn't something that I was really, you know, big into. I thought you get guys strong, you get them explosive, and that's about all you really cared about. And then I opened a gym back in 2003, and lo and behold, I started working with a bunch of fighters, and it was really just proximity more than anything else. I happened to be right next to AMC Kickboxing and the, you know, world-class MMA center. And I knew what sport was, but I really wasn't, you know, a super fan of it. I'd seen it here and there, but other than that, I didn't know much about it. And one day I just had these guys walk me over to my gym and tell me to get ready for a fight over in Japan and need, you know, if I could train them. And so I said, sure. I really didn't know, you know, a whole lot about what I was doing back then. It was more just trial and error. And my first instinct, of course, was to start working with them and seeing what they were made of, and I found out they were real weak and not real powerful, and thought, well, I just got to make these guys real strong, real powerful, and they'll be way better. And that was kind of what I did in the beginning, and then I started doing some of the training myself, and I realized real quick that was not the best strategy, because, you know, I was much stronger and more powerful than they were, and they were kicking my ass all over the place within 30 seconds because I was gassed out and, you know, getting choked out. And so I thought, there's more to this than I thought. And so I started really just, you know, an 8-year kind of quest of figuring out what the energy systems are all about and how to get guys ready for fights. And really just took me in a whole different direction than I was ever on before that, because, you know, you realize real quick once you start training it and once you start working those guys that, you know, if you don't have the strength and power to last more than 30 seconds, you're not going to get very far. And so really, you know, it's just been a journey of just working with guys and learning more about the sport and more about the athletes and having a chance to do it myself and work with a coach like Matt Hume, who's, you know, absolutely one of the best in the game, and you know, he's got 20 years of experience, so I've been fortunate to work with him and just learn as I go. And so, you know, it's like I never would have expected to be known as the conditioning guy or the energy systems guy or any of those things. I was a strength and power guy and I worked with a guy named Bill Gillespie, who's a world-class 800-pound-plus puncher, and that was kind of my background. So it's just one of those things, you know, it's not what I expected, but it's obviously worked out well for me, and it's really forced me to become a better coach because of it.
That's really cool. You know, it's funny. I did a little bit of work with Bill. I was helping with the women's volleyball team for a little while at the UW, and I bet we, like, passed each other in the hallways or something like that over there. I just left Seattle just about the time that you opened up your spot, so that's kind of funny. Small circle. Do you feel like the strength and power background, do you feel like that gives you a little bit of an edge over the folks that come into it with, you know, maybe conditioning first and then the strength and power second? I mean, because it seems like you're able to dot the I's and cross the T's on that very, very effectively, and then really give some. It's kind of like, okay, that's the easy part. And then, you know, you're able to graft on the conditioning. I mean, is that an oversimplification, or would you agree with that?
No, I mean, I think definitely. Well, I think it did two things for me. Number one, you know, I definitely do consider the strength and power kind of easy part in there, and kind of, you know, compared to what an NFL athlete or, more strength and power dominant athlete needs, the needs of an MMA athlete are relatively simple. But really what it did is I really did not know that much about conditioning. It was something I wasn't, I thought conditioning was running 110-meter sprints with 30 seconds rest because that's what we did for football. And it just forced me to really come at it from a different perspective, I think, than other people that maybe had a little bit more of a conditioning background that thought they knew what they were doing. They would just kind of, go with what they knew and assume they had it dialed in. But I really came at it from, once I realized how little I knew about it, I wanted to do the best job I could for these guys. And the last thing I wanted to do was have them go into a fight and not be prepared because of something I had done wrong. And so I think that just that the background I had really forced me to forget everything I knew and start from scratch. And, really it was doing that that took me down the path that I ended up going down and learning as much as I was able to because I just, I'd always known with strength and power. When you realize that that's a very small part of it, there's much more to the game than that. You just have to be humble about it and start over. And that's kind of what I was forced to do. So, yeah, I mean, definitely now if someone's conditioning is there and they just want to get stronger and more explosive, I mean, that's super easy. I'm stoked because that's the easiest part of the game you can work with.
Nice. So, how did you, what was the process of kind of dissecting? Let's take maybe MMA and then maybe a little bit of jiu-jitsu separately because they're kind of different sports. But how would you, you're rolling into this. You've got mainly like a strength and power-oriented background. You realize that there's some conditioning deficiencies with these guys. You're dealing with some orthopedic stuff. You're getting them strong. You're getting them powerful. Now you're wanting to build an engine for their sport. How did you get in and start dissecting what the demands of the sport were to then give specific prescriptions? Because like you have some pretty cool stuff like tempo intervals and stuff like that, which we'll talk about later. Like how did you look at the demands of the sport and then start building from that a conditioning a plan built around just the, what you were observing the demands of the sport were?
It was definitely, it was an ongoing process. It really wasn't something that happened overnight. And I think the first, probably the biggest thing, like I said, I started doing some of the work with the athletes myself, and I started actually training the sport and working with them in their sport. And that was really the first step because it gave me a whole new understanding. I mean, it's one thing to say, I want to get you in shape. It's another thing to understand what that actually means because you felt what not having it feels like. So as soon as I started working with them, I really just started training, and that kind of took me down the thought process. And from there, it was I've always been kind of a numbers guy, an analytical guy, and so I started actually just testing them and everything I could think of. I started testing their rest and heart rate. I had the Omega Wave even back then, which is a pretty high dollar system that allowed me to kind of look at their makeup of energy systems. I could see their VO2, I could see their lactate threshold, I could see their profile of their energy systems. And so I just kind of had a way to kind of start mapping out what are the guys, what are the guys looking like that are well conditioned versus what are the guys looking like that aren't well conditioned. And then I started to just kind of figure out what the difference was. And then I would do some stuff with heart rate monitors and figure out how to put a heart rate monitor on somebody and have them train and not break a thing in the process and start to look at, look at what the heart rate data showed me. And really just over time, kind of building a model, like I said, of here's what a successful, well-conditioned MMA athlete looks like or jiu-jitsu athlete looks like, and here's what one who isn't in shape looks like. And then, from there, just kind of figure out, like I said, what's the difference? Why is this guy in shape and this guy's not in shape? Why is this guy gassing out one round while this guy's lasting three rounds? And really, I was fortunate because I was working with Matt and all the fighters at AMC, so I had a big range of guys at my disposal. I had guys coming in from out of town that were obviously out of shape. I had guys that we were getting ready for fights. And so I was just able to build what benchmarks kind of over time of like I said, the ideal model. It's really, we look at the NFL Combine now, and they put guys through a bunch of physical tests, and because they know that if you're able to jump 40 inches and your 40-yard dash is, 4.3, that doesn't guarantee you're going to be successful, but it's an indication you're explosive, and that's an important quality of football. And so just over time, I was able to kind of pick out these traits that I knew were important, that I knew were benchmarks for a well-conditioned guy and where he should be at different points in time in his fight, and just looking at his heart rate recovery between rounds. And so it's just kind of ongoing, and I'm still evaluating that now. I'm still building that model, and obviously I've got a lot of data now and a lot of experience doing it, but it's just been a constant process of collecting information and looking at it and working with the guys and seeing how they're doing and looking at looking at the performance changes with different markers of different areas, and it's just a ongoing thing.
That's super cool. Now, in your day-to-day practice, how much of your practice is devoted to what I would, you know, anybody would consider like an athletic scene versus like your general population, you know, moms, dads, you know, coming in trying to just get in shape and stuff like that? Like, how does your practice play out day-to-day?
Personally, my own time has been mostly with the athletic population. Now I work with, you know, maybe two or three people that are just kind of general population that want to get in shape. And most of my time has been either with fighters or we do a lot of work with high school athletes, of course, and even the roller derby team, which is an interesting group, and I've worked with
nice.
Ultimate Frisbee, and yeah, I'm just kind of around. It's an interesting mix of Ultimate Frisbee and fighters and roller derby all in the same gym, that's for sure. But
that sounds like a battle royale.
So it is awesome. If you were to just glove up the roller derby people and the ultimate frisbee people and just like 3-2-1 go, like battle royale, last one standing wins, who do you think would win, roller derby or ultimate?
I go to ultimate frisbee, but actually what we want to do is get the women's lingerie football league to fight the roller derby girls. We thought that would be a good one.
that would be legit. Wellborn's been training some of the lingerie football league gals down in Southern California. That's a really good gig. Unfortunately, Reno doesn't have much of that going on, so I won't
shocking,
be
really.
Yeah, I won't be tapping into that market. Unfortunately,
well, those girls actually, I went to a game and they hit a lot harder than you expect. I mean, they actually made each other out pretty good. I was surprised.
Yeah, that's what Wellborn said. It was pretty impressive. So, Joel, what would I'm gonna be a little bit selfish here and ask some questions very directed at my stuff. I'm doing like old dude jujitsu. I weigh like 175-ish pounds. Not really looking at competing, you know, but just wanting my game to be good. I'm 40 years old. Like, what type of metrics are you looking at? Like let's work from kind of like a strength side. Like, are there some strength standards that you would say, okay, I'd like a person to have this, this, and this, like some mobility standards, and then moving into some conditioning standards? Or, you know, what if I rolled into your gym, what would you want to see from me as far as, like weight room and conditioning characteristics to say, okay, at least this guy's got a chance to have the attributes to go and do well doing Brazilian jiu-jitsu?
Yeah, I mean, jiu-jitsu is an interesting game, obviously, because it's you know, the positions of jiu-jitsu are so unique and specific to the sport. It's not like you're going to find a whole lot of movements in the weight room. They're going to correlate super highly. But, you know, I'll put guys through just a basic, you know, squat, deadlift, bench, pull-ups, you know, explosive push-ups. It's really just the basic strength lifts. And, you know, you don't need a super high level of any of those, but they're, you know, your ability to do them is going to be just indicative of your general central nervous system function, your general strength. It doesn't always translate directly in the mat, but at least give me something to work with, and then I'll literally watch guys on the mat, and that's as important, I think, or a role with myself, and that's as important of a evaluation as anything. And, you know, from there, we'll start to look at metrics of the conditioning that they're going to... I've got a conditioning circuit, basically, that I put people through. It's a 25 to 35-minute... process. It's a great just general kind of all around aerobic fitness, you know, circuit that correlates real well with different areas. And then, you know, obviously we'll work with mobility and look at their movement, and as much as anything, I'll work with Matt and we'll watch guys roll, we'll watch guys train and get a lot out of that, which is something I think unfortunately a lot of strength coaches, you know, might not have access to, you know, talking to the coach about sport and say, what do you see in their sport that is lacking, or where they're strengths, where their weaknesses, and that's something that I've been able to do a lot with, of, you know, literally talking to Matt and saying, look, you know, what are these guys, where do you think their areas are good, and where are their areas not as good, because, you know, he's been in the sport forever, and he'll watch guys roll, or he'll roll with them, and he'll spar with them, and that's his evaluation, so we're able to kind of take the total picture of the athlete, and I might see, well, you know, their strength in these lifts isn't great, but he'll tell me, you know, in the jiu-jitsu game, or in striking, they're you know, they're plenty strong, they're plenty explosive. It's more conditioning, and usually what we find is everything that I see in the weight room, and my kind of assessment is right on par with what he sees, and he'll tell me aspects of the how they applied their strength or didn't apply their strength, or, you know, if maybe they're in great shape but their technique was horrible, so they just wasted much energy. But really, it's important, I think, for anyone to be evaluated from kind of both performance skill standpoint and the strength conditioning standpoint as a whole.
Right.
And when you try and you look at things separately, the strength coach might come to not have a full picture. You know, you might not know how the actual performance plays on the field. And we have to always consider most of what we do is fairly general in the weight room for like jiu-jitsu. I'm not, you know, I don't have guys in my weight room on my floor trying to simulate jiu-jitsu moves in the most part because they get a lot of that already. It's a very specific, you know, skill. And so I'm always going to consider that a lot of what I do for those guys is a general strength, is a general training that I'm going to have to talk to Matt and see what they do as far as their specific application of that. And then, you know, from there we kind of develop the game plan and figure out what they need to work on and then, you know, go about doing it.
Very cool. So what would be strength numbers that would make you happy for me, like a squat, a dead, a bench, a weighted pull-up? You know, what would be just some strength metrics that you would be like, okay, that all other things considered, that's probably pretty good to go?
Yeah, I mean, if someone's able to squat maybe 1.5 times their body weight, bench their body weight, deadlift 1.5, 2 times their body weight, probably not that much, probably at least 1.5 times, and then do a decent number of pull-ups and explosive push-ups and able to just look like they've got some technique and form in those, then they're more than adequate. I mean, most jiu-jitsu guys aren't real strong in the core lifts unless they've done them frequently. So, it's a little bit, it's not always a fair evaluation. If you've never done a lift, which some of these guys coming from a background and really haven't done a lift.
Right.
You know, I'm not gonna judge them and say you're completely weak, even though in the weight room, you know, your numbers aren't great, but on the mat, you're killing people and you're overpowering people. So I'll always kind of take their background into context, but, you know, generally if you're doing the 1.5 times the body weight in the squat and the deadlift and benching your body weight and doing, you know, 18, 20 pull-ups, you're probably pretty well covered in that department.
Nice. Hey, so where do you start thinking about, like, supplemental conditioning, you know, like you mentioned, your aerobic conditioning circuit and stuff like that, versus just doing more kind of SPP, like sport specific training? You know, is your ideal scenario such that, you know, like shift gears and talk about an MMA person, like would the ideal scenario be just more light, you know, like clinch work, grappling, pad and bag work, light sparring to do more kind of a dynamic live training? Or like how do you split that stuff up? Like when is it enough doing sport specific stuff versus, you know, you're going to do kind of an aerobic circuit or like the tempo intervals or something like that? Like how do you divide that stuff up?
I mean, a lot of it's going to depend on the needs of the athlete and kind of, you know, the fighter, when we're at and where we're trying to develop. I mean, say they don't have any fight coming up and, you know, we've realize that one of the big areas that they need to improve upon is their strength and conditioning, or that's their conditioning, their last condition, the last fight didn't go well, and they need to get in better shape. And, I'm of the opinion that that's not something you develop 6 weeks out or 5 weeks out or even 8 weeks out. It's something that you need to develop as a quality, you know, year-round. In particular, if it's a weakness that you need to improve, then we're going to start to devote some time to it, and that's where, we're gonna do both. And it's always, in person, my opinion, it's always a question of, you know, how you spend your time between the skill work and the strength conditioning work. And, you know, first and foremost, I'm my job in the strength conditioning field is to not impede your skill work. I mean, if I'm beating you up in the weight room and you can't go over and train because I'm killing you in the weight room, then you're not doing your job as an athlete and you're not able to improve your skills. And so I'm, you know, always conscious of that, but we're definitely going to spend some time in my work with you working on strength and working on the conditioning side and working on those tempo intervals and working on maybe the road work 2.0 intervals or doing those sort of things. And then in addition to that, you know, if obviously Matt will be on the same page and that's kind of the goal of what we're working on, his training might be, you know, a little bit higher volume, a little bit lower intensity, just getting more specific conditioning work in the skill side as well. And it's always the question of, you know, how we put those pieces together. And that's where, you know, he and I are always talking. But it's just kind of dependent on where the fighter's at. I mean, if they're getting ready for a fight, then it becomes a different story. Obviously, and conditioning is the whole focus. And that's where, you know, really start to spend the last, I would say, 3 to 4 weeks of a fight preparation game. I probably play more of a maintenance role than anything else and just keep them healthy and maintain their strength and power. And that's where all their specific work, you know, starts to be conditioning in the forms of bag work and pad work and rounds and rolling and, grilling, the more specific that they can get. And during the last few weeks, the better, and stuff they're doing in the weight room is really just kind of designed to support that. So that's something I think a lot of fighters kind of mistake, really. They just go in the weight room and they do explosive work, and then they're doing intervals, and they're just killing themselves, and then they've got nothing left, and it goes time to spar. I mean, they're just shot, and they're sore, and they're beat up, and they spar a couple rounds, and they're just shot. They're not getting the quality of work that they need to get that aspect, a very specific aspect of conditioning. So, you know, I think it's always an important game and or important area of a game like MMA or jiu-jitsu where you're training 5-6 days a week, that you realize that your strength conditioning and your skill work is not two separate pieces. I mean, everything you do in one aspect is going to affect the other, and you have to be very careful about, you know, how you approach the overall program, because otherwise you end up, you know, either you don't develop the kind of fitness you want to develop, or you don't have the energy that it takes to improve your skill, because you're just always fatigued. You're always kind of in this chronic state of depleted energy. You just never feel like you're 100%. You're always tired. You're always beat up. And that's not a way to get ready for a fight. It's not a way to improve over the long run either.
You know, Joel, you were one of the early folks kind of talking about like the challenges of taking like a CrossFit type template and overlaying that in an athletic scene, and kind of the competitive signaling that happens with that, you know, dumping both the, you know, kind of, mTOR, you know, AMPK, you know, signaling, which is more strength and power oriented versus these pathways that are much more endurance oriented. Could you talk to folks a little bit about that? 'Cause, you know, like the gym that we have, we're probably a flip of what you're doing. We're probably 95% generalist conditioning, and then maybe about 5% of folks that are a legit athlete, you know, some police, some military, some fire, guys like Glenn Cordoza that you know, do some MMA fighting and whatnot. So a very flip demographic. And for like that generalist demographic, some sort of a mixed modal training thing seems fine, but then, you know, really, really early on for me, it became clear that, you know, mixing strength and endurance for an athlete, like you said, it just left them depleted. They didn't have enough capacity to get in and do really high quality skill work. It was really, really difficult to dial in the volume and intensity that they could survive. You know, like one day they were doing pretty good, the next day they were blown out of the water. But could you talk to people a little bit about why mixing those modalities is maybe not a great idea if you're really wanting to get some elite level overall performance?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really comes back to kind of, you know, how the body is designed to work, and really, you know, it's designed to adapt to what you do to it. But we have to consider that the ability to produce high levels of strength and very high levels of power, you know, largely comes down to building a gigantic anaerobic engine that produces ATP and, you know, the energy you need as rapidly as possible in massive force. I mean, it's a dragster that wants to go down the quarter mile, 300 miles per hour. And then we went with the other side, which is the endurance aspect, which is really, you know, you're not producing 8,000 horsepower. You're producing a much more moderate level, but you're able to sustain that for, you know, 5 rounds or 3 rounds or, you know, hours on end if you're an endurance athlete. And that's much more about economy. I mean, we don't want to produce energy as fast as possible. We don't want to produce the highest forces. We just want to maintain that force for as long as we need to for our sport. And if we look at it from that standpoint, I mean, the idea of building massive endurance and building massive strength and power at the same time is really, it's conflicting demand on the body, because those are two different things. On the one hand, we're wanting to produce lots of force, be very explosive and very rapidly be able to create energy. On the other hand, we're saying, no, we want to be very economical. We want to be getting 50 miles a gallon. We want to be, you know, the endurance athlete. Those are very different demands on the body. And the body is set up in a way that it doesn't make sense for it to, you know, optimally respond to both from that standpoint, because a bigger engine requires more energy, is less fuel efficient. You know, a car that goes 50 miles a gallon is not going to put out 500 horsepower. It's not going to happen, because there's such different ends of the spectrum. And so we look at just kind of how the body is signaling and set up, and we see that if we're placing a great amount of strength demand in our body and very little conditioning, it's going to improve much better than if we're trying to do everything all at once. And you really are only going to see those types of improvements where, you know, your strength and your power and your conditioning and all those things improve at once if you're at a fairly, you know, low to moderate level. And if you're a couch potato, you're in fairly bad shape. Obviously, those things can improve a lot because they're at such a low level to begin with, and it's fairly easy. But once you get up to moderate level, if we start trying to tell the body, hey, we want you to get stronger, we want you to be more explosive, we want you to get in better shape all at once, it's kind of designed to just find the middle ground because you're telling it to do something that's very opposite. And we can't tell it, I want to have a 500 power or 500 horsepower engine, but I want you to go for hours on end. It just doesn't make sense. And so the body's really kind of designed in a way so those signals from either side, from the endurance or the strength, they interfere with each other. They cancel each other out in some respects to where you're not going to optimally improve either one. You're really just going to kind of stick in this kind of compromised middle ground, and the body will do the best it can to kind of find the balance. And it's not going to ever, it's not going to just develop them all at once forever. It's going to kind of sit there and not really improve either way because the body's not designed to do that. It can't meet both those demands at once. And so I think, yeah, for the average person who's just kind of getting into the game and wants to get in shape and they're just kind of getting off the couch, I mean, absolutely, you can improve everything. You can train all at once. You just need to get in the gym and train. But, for the high-level athlete who really wants to improve their performance, I mean, you need to get whatever area you need to get improved. You need to train that particular area because that's going to be the limiting factor. I mean, a football player is going to have much different limiting factors than a fighter or an endurance athlete, and to think that we can improve all those areas at once and everybody forever, it's just not how the body was designed, and it doesn't make sense from a fundamental standpoint of endurance versus explosiveness and, economy versus strength and power. They're just very different ends of the spectrum. You want to be able to improve them. You're going to have to spend time working them in a way that's most efficient, and at some point that becomes, focusing on those areas rather than thinking you're going to improve them all at once.
And having a good coach assess it and say, okay, I think you need to emphasize some anaerobic or some aerobic endurance, and we're going to tackle that in the block periodization, and then maybe put you on like a strength maintenance deal that's kind of maybe like a relatively high intensity but low volume for a block. Like, would that be one way that you would tackle that?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, once you reach a point where you're not going to improve everything at once, then yeah, exactly, it becomes a point of, we're going to improve this area, we're going to focus on this area while we, maintain and not lose performance in these other areas. And it's actually a pretty similar kind of developmental process to MMA itself. I mean, when you first get in the game, I mean, you suck at everything, right? You can get better at rolling, you can get better at striking, you can get better at the wrestling. You can improve every single aspect, really, with just minimal effort because you're so bad at all of them.
Right.
But once you become fairly proficient, I mean, I can't go in the gym every single day and improve my wrestling, and improve my jiu-jitsu, improve my striking, kind of all at once. I'm going to have to start to realize that I'm going to have holes in my game that need improvement. If I want to improve them, then I've got to put all my time working there, and I can't spend as much time doing the other things because there's only so many hours in a day. I can only train for so long before I have nothing left. And so I'm going to have to spend more time working on something that I want to improve. I mean, maybe I realize my striking sucks, and I'm going to have to spend time training that. But in that time spent, I have now less time to train the other areas. And so I think it's very similar to just fitness in general. I mean, you can improve everything to a point, but when you really want to start getting better, once you reach that higher level, you have to spend your time focusing on that area. And then really the goal is just maintaining the other areas. And it's a kind of constant process of evaluating where am I at and what do I need to keep improving and, what's the best way to do that. And once you get to a certain level, the answer is you've got to spend time working in the areas that need to be worked on, and that leaves less time and less of a reason to train the other ones as much, and your goal is just to maintain, and that's where the block system starts to really come into play.
This is maybe a leading question, but do you feel like maybe the biggest mistake that folks are making is just not realizing when they transition from like that beginner to intermediate to advanced individual, and that they're the thing that worked for them early, maybe doing everything at once, that they, they're just not realizing, okay, I've got to change gears and like start breaking it apart and then reintegrating it in, say, like fight camp or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's easy to kind of get used to, hey, this worked for me before, why isn't it working for me now? And just think that, I think that people most often think, well, it's not working because I just need to work harder, or I just need to do more of it. And they don't realize, like, no, it's not working because you've reached a level where you need a new strategy. You need something different now. What got you to that level is not going to get you to the next level. And so I think our American kind of mindset is the harder I work, the better results are going to be. And if I'm not getting the results I want to, then I just need to work harder. That's kind of our philosophy these days. And I think people just don't realize that once you get to, once you've achieved a certain level of fitness, or you've achieved a certain level of skill in MMA, you know, it takes a different approach. It takes a different strategy. It takes a different mindset to continue to improve. And I think a lot of people do. They get off the couch and they make rapid improvements and they get better. And then they stop getting better and their improvements slow down a lot. So they think, oh, okay, I'll train harder. I'll train harder. And that works, you know, maybe for a little while, but sooner or later, you know, it takes more than just hard work. And that's not the only part of the equation that's important. And it takes a well-developed plan and an actual organized, structured training program that's designed around you and your ability to train. It's not just going to the gym and train hard anymore. And if you want to get better, that's what it takes. But I think people are not cognizant of, you know, I reached a point where now I need a more structured plan where just getting in the gym and training is not going to be enough. And so exactly, you know, I think people kind of fail to realize that just because something worked for them when they're a beginner doesn't mean it's going to work for them when they're more advanced or they're ready for more structure, more organization, and more specific to them, more individualized training. They just don't realize, hey, look, this is what it's going to take to continue to improve, because we've been just kind of taught the harder you work, the more results you get. And so that's kind of their approach, and sooner or later, you just have to take it past that if you really want to improve.
Yeah, and it's funny, within that athlete scene, like it almost becomes a role of like reining these folks in. Like the, you know, they're willing and able to like grind themselves down to a nub. Like there's nothing left except a smoking husk, you know, and you almost have to be willing to like jump on them and save them from themselves. Cause they'll just, you know, working with Glenn and some other folks, like they would be so broken and you couldn't, you know, it's almost like you had to put a low jack on them to make sure that they weren't out like doing sprints or something like that when they were gone. So, yeah.
MMA in particular, I mean, the MMA athlete, you know, they're a marvel of work ethic, a lot of them. And they'll run themselves literally into the ground doing what they think they have to do to get better. And the sad point is a lot of times they're not getting better and they're just doing it to do it. And, you know, we've had guys that come into our camp that have been, you know, other camps over the years, and they're holding their career now. And you see the effects of the approach. I mean, they literally would say, you know, I'll ask for their program, oh, you know, we spar. And we train and we spar. I'm like, well, what do you do on other days? It's like, no, we train and we spar every day. That's all we do. And they do that for years on end, and they just run themselves into the ground, and you realize that, you know, they're in their mid-20s or late 20s, and they're just beat up. I mean, they just don't have, you know, they just don't have what it takes to get much further, because they've just decimated themselves over the years with this approach. I'm going to go in the gym and spar as hard as I can every day, and that's going to make me a better fighter. And that, you know, all I have to do is go in there and beat everybody up in the gym, and I'm going to learn how to be, you know, I'm going to be the best. And it's just, you know, it's, I think at some point they all start to realize, like, well, that's not really doing the job anymore. It's just a question of how long it takes them to realize that. And if they don't have a coach that, you know, says, hey, we need to stop and think about things, and, you know, maybe what we're doing of, you know, maybe killing yourself every day is not the right approach. You know, if they don't have that in place, and a lot of combat athletes will just do it indefinitely until they can't do it anymore, and they end up, you know, with just all kinds of injuries and just beat the crap. And I've seen it, you know, unfortunately, a lot of times the guys that come in from other camps, and I think that's why we see, you know, a lot of fights now are being canceled. If you're having guys, the veterans, they're just beat up. I mean, they just can't take it anymore. All the guys down in Brazil that beat the crap out of each other, and guys in different camps from the U.S. beat the crap out of each other. I mean, the older MMA athletes are just falling apart, and there's a big reason for it, and they just abuse themselves for a long time because no one told them not to, and it's unfortunate, and you know, that's kind of what I try to talk about. It's just, you don't have to kill yourself every day to get better. It's about more than that.
And you know, it happens at a point where, I mean, they maybe can't get away with this from just, you know, being like 18 to 24 years old, but really these people should be entering the prime of their fighting career, because they still should be strong and explosive and have good cardio and everything. But then they, you know, you start hitting that like 28 to 32 years old, you should also have that, you know, from like the talent code, you know, this myelination of your nervous system. Like you should have tens of thousands of hours of repetitions hanging out in your brain to be able to capitalize on, but you can't beat yourself into dog piss every single training session and expect to show up on game day. I mean, would you agree with that? I mean, these guys, I've seen a number of people, they start hitting like 28 to 30 and the wheels are just falling off the wagon on these guys, when in fact they should be like at the absolute height of their career. It shouldn't be going down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, like I said, once you get to a point in your career where you've trained hours and hours, and you know, you've spent years developing your skill, it's completely unfortunate that you've destroyed your body in the process, and now you're not even able to use your skill because you've done that to yourself. And you know, exactly, I would say, you know, mid-20s, late-20s, you know, maybe early-30s, you're at the latest, you're seeing guys just really start to fall apart, and every training camp, it's more of like, you know, can I keep this guy healthy than can I get him in shape? The challenge just becomes, I want to keep him in the gym, and he's so beat up that I just want to maintain his ability to train more than anything else, and you know, it's trying to band-aid him together than more than it is actually quality training and quality conditioning. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, in your early 20s, you're a beast. You can kind of just power your way through that. You have hormones or everything's at the top of your game and your machine. And then the problem is once those things start to change a little bit, you just kind of all start to, you know, it all starts to go. And, you know, one injury leads to another injury leads to another injury. And, you know, that's kind of when guys unfortunately fall apart. And you know, it's sad. Like you said, they should be at the top of their career. They should have, you know, developed a well-rounded game at that point. They should be, you know, ready to make most of career. Instead, they're just trying to stay healthy and get from one fight to the next. And MMA is particularly a brutal sport because you can get cut. You know, UFC has the ability to cut you if you lose any fight. Mm-hmm. And so everything's right in the line. I mean, you're literally one or two bad performances and you're out of UFC. And especially nowadays, I mean, there's not that many places that you can go if you do that. So you know, you can train for 10 years and get your shot and, you know, have a couple bad fights and you're done. And right. You know, it could be nothing more than you beat yourself up in the process to get to that point, and once you get there, you just don't have the ability to train without falling apart, and you're never going to make the most of the opportunity you finally got for yourself. So it's definitely a frustrating thing to watch happen, and you know, I see it with people that kind of come into our camp that have been elsewhere for a long time, and obviously we're cognizant of not letting that happen to our own athletes, but you know, when you see guys coming out of other camps and coming in with us and they're 29, 30 years old and, you know, they've had 3 surgeries and they can barely train. It's you know, there's not a lot you can do. And it's unfortunate. Just kind of the mentality of the sport and the training that a lot of them do is just not very well thought out for the long term. You know, they really just kind of focus on what's in front of them rather than kind of thinking the big picture of development.
Right. Yeah, it's a double-edged sword. Like the guys that like to do this type of thing for a living, you're wired up a little bit differently, and the ability to rein them in can be tough. Like it's definitely a different type of animal to deal with. That's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, like, you know, exactly. Double edged sword is a good way to look at it. I mean, I love the guys that'll run through brick walls. I tell them to, and they'll do exactly what I ask of them. And they, those are the guys that you want in the gym. But at the same time, you know, if you put them in the wrong system, and someone's telling them literally to run through the wall every day, they're going to do it, and sooner or later they're going to pay the consequences.
We see this a lot. I do some work with Naval Special Warfare, and you see that in that community a lot, too. So, yeah, it's interesting. Hey, what got you – let's talk a little bit about, like, Road Work 2.0 and then Tim Bosch and his UFC 144 comeback. Like, that's
yeah, the hell of a fight,
really,
wasn't it?
Really, really amazing stuff. Yeah, tell folks about Road Work 2.0. You just did an article on that. And then tell them about Tim and his whole story.
Yeah, I mean, Road Work 2.0 was just kind of, I wanted to get this idea out there that, you know, the old, good old-fashioned road work and putting some miles in and volume, it's not always the killer it's made out to be. I think that we've kind of had this overreactive backlash against anything that's not explosive, and people have, you know, think that if you go out and you run a little bit, you're literally going to, your testosterone's going to go down, you're going to lose muscle mass, and your explosiveness is going to fall apart overnight. And, you know, people have just kind of put this out there that everything you're doing condition-wise has to be specific, or everything has to be explosive, or it's a waste of time. And, you know, I mean, if we just look at kind of the history of combat sports, when we look at wrestlers for years on end, we look at boxers, we look at, you know, most combat athletes have done road work and have done kind of the longer, slower, you know, aerobic-based building. And, you know, we've seen it work. I mean, we've literally seen heavyweight boxers go for 15 rounds and be well-conditioned, and now we literally see guys gas out in one round that have done nothing but intervals. And so there's a reason that you need higher volumes. It builds the vascular reactions. It builds different areas of cardiac output that you're not going to get with intervals, because if you're really doing a high-intensity interval, you're not going to do the volume that it takes to develop those areas, and you're not going to put the time in. So I just wanted to, you know, give people some information about why you can still do those things, and you don't always have to go out and hit the pavement. You don't have to go run, you know, 3 or 4 miles a day. You can get that work in the gym in a little bit lower impact way, which is important for fighting, and you can do it, you know, doing incorporating some specific drills. So, you know, years ago I started having guys, I've got just kind of a bunch of machines in my gym. I've got the Jacob's Ladder, an Endless Rope, a Woodway Force, you know, a spin bike, just different stuff where you have to actually propel yourself. It's non-motorized cardio, if you want to look at it that way. And so you're able to put the work in and you're able to go at your own pace, but it's all low impact versus a climber. It's, you know, it's all very low impact. And so we started doing basically our kind of our work version of road work in the gym, where you're not putting the wear and tear of running on the pavement and doing that mile after mile is, you know, obviously a good thing. So we started just doing some circuits into the gym where you do 10 minutes maybe shadow boxing, and then 10 minutes jump rope, and then maybe you jump on the ladder for 5 minutes, and maybe you jump on the VersaClimber for 5 minutes. And, you know, it's a way to get the same type of adaptation, because most of that is centrally driven in the heart itself. And, you know, without having to go out and run for miles on end and then tear yourself down a little bit. And, you know, there is something to be said for not overdoing that. I mean, there's definitely, it's not a great idea to go run mile after mile after mile after mile endless days, but we want to get some of those you know, improvements, and so this is a good way to do that. And so that's something I'd worked with. It was great timing for the article, because, you know, Tim's fight obviously was a big fight over in Japan, and Okami's, you know, one of the best in the world. He's number three in the world in middleweight, and Tim was a huge underdog in that fight, and it's an method that we've used with him, because he's one of those guys that we're talking about. I mean, Tim will beat the shit out of himself if you let him, or if you tell him to. I mean, he will overwork, you know, outwork anyone in there if that's what you tell him to do. But using the Omega Wave and using my own HRV system, I've seen that Tim is not one of these guys that recovers very well from that approach. And if you let him, you know, he will very quickly go into an overtrained state, and he will not do well. And so we've had to kind of rein Tim in over the, you know, last couple of years we've been working with him, and realize that this guy needs to be closely managed and closely monitored, because he does go hard, so hard when he's, you know, in the gym, that if we don't take some lower intensity work with him, if we don't, you know, build that stuff up, and if we just let him kind of go after it, he will overtrain very quickly. And so tempo intervals and road work 2.0 and kind of this more volume approach, and not always just letting the intensity be the driving factor, is a big part of how we've, you know, developed him over the last couple of years, and what, again, you know, an area of his game we've really worked on to improve. So, you know, of course, he goes over there in Japan, and, you know, do you see the fight, I'm assuming?
Yeah, I did, yeah.
I mean, he was not doing well, to say the least. I mean, he just, you know, he wasn't looking like he had been looking in training. He wasn't doing the things that, you know, he'd been drilled to do. And he was standing at the end of Okami's range, and he was just kind of getting picked apart and beat up, and, you know, he was taking hard shots, and he just wasn't finding his game. He wasn't doing the things that he needed to do. And, you know, going in that second round, I mean, he went for a guillotine, that put him in a bad spot, he didn't get it. And, you know, Okami ended up on top and was just raining down punches, and, you know, definitely wasn't looking good. And then you could hear Matt in the corner tell him, like, your conditioning's good, your heart rate's good, you know, you can still win this fight, and you gotta get aggressive, you gotta go after it. And you could see something just came in the third round, and he did exactly what he was supposed to do, and he did what he had trained to do, and it finally just kind of clicked. And, you know, 50 whatever seconds was later, Okami was knocked out, and Tim won. And it was, you know, it was a great testament to the fact that, you know, you don't always have to kill yourself, because a lot of, I would say probably, you know, 60-70% of Tim's training was at a fairly, you know, low to moderate level. We really just can't let him do more than that, because he will overtrain. And so it's just a great testament that someone at the 185-pound division of the UFC can spend a good amount of time at lower and moderate intensities and not kill himself, and go in there in a fight like that in the third round against top ranked, you know, top three ranked middleweight in the world, and win a fight because they were fresh enough to use their strength and power and to knock somebody out.
Right.
And, it was just great timing, because, you know, like I said, just kind of put that article out there, and it's funny, I get a mixture of kind of people coming back at me and saying, oh, this is great, you know, I've kind of felt this way, and just kind of validates what I've been doing and how I felt my own training. And then you get some other guys saying, no, this is bullshit. You know, where's the research? And it's about this, it's about that. And you don't need to do that stuff. You know, so I say, well, look at the, you know, do what you want, but here's the results, you know.
I love the folks that ask for some research and they don't even have the chat. Like, if you gave them research, if it existed, I mean, how do you do a control on shit like this? You know, it's fucking ridiculous. And then, if you were to give them research, do they have the chops to be able to analyze it, whether the research was worth anything or it should line a birdcage? You know, it's just kind of ridiculous, you know.
Rob, look at this for me and tell me what you think.
The Tabata research itself, for God's sakes, had 30 minutes of low-intensity training in the high-intensity group.
Right.
I mean, then that's used as the kind of end-all, you know, be-all research. And if you do a little bit more comprehensive research, you know, you basically find that, you know, if you do a pretty low-intensity work, then, yeah, you see different changes, and the changes come slower, but they still come. I mean, the group and the endurance side of Tabata stuff still made improvements in VO2 max. It probably wouldn't have taken 60 minutes a day. They probably would have gotten something similar in 20 or 30 because they're relatively untrained, but they still made improvements, and they made them much more consistently through the 6 weeks. The Tabata, the intensity group, improved most of their VO2 within the first 3 weeks and tended to plateau for the second 3 weeks, whereas the lower intensity group was pretty uniform in their improvement throughout that 6 week process. So I think we just tend to look at these short range kind of 4 week or 6 week chunks of research and think, well, that's great, the higher intensity group worked. And I kind of talked about in the HOV book I sent you, it's kind of the crash diet approach. You know, if I only had 4 weeks to lose weight and I just didn't eat, I'd probably lose more weight than somebody who had a very, you know, kind of moderate caloric deficit. But is that the right approach? You know, do I want to stop eating or starve myself? I mean, obviously, works great in the short run, but that's a terrible, you know, long-term fat loss solution.
Especially if you have performance waiting at the end of that thing, you know. So tell us about, I think you popped up on the site when we had the question originally about like heart rate variability, and I misread the damn thing and thought it was just heart rate in general, and I was kind of commenting on, you know, like waking heart rate and stuff like that. And tell us about how you've come to this looking at heart rate variability. And I still have some questions. You know, where is heart, you know, what is heart rate variability? What is it that it's telling us? And why is that a better metric than just like waking up in the morning and looking at our waking heart rate and using that as a little bit of a guide for like, are we overtrained or, you know, that whole gig?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because the technology itself has been around for a long time, and the Russians kind of developed it initially as part of their space program, and a lot of people don't know this, but it was literally used on the first person in space was used to beam down information from space to the cosmonauts, to the space program, to basically look at the stress on the athletes, or the stress on the cosmonaut, and see how he's doing up in space, because it was very easy to send down a little heart rate pulse so they could analyze it. So it's been around for a long time. It just really hasn't been, you know, available to the general public or well-known or well-publicized. And it's funny because Polar actually uses some HRV in some of their higher-end heart rate monitors, but they've literally never promoted it as HRV or done much to let the consumer know that it's actually in their watches or it's a feature. But really, it's quite a bit different than just looking at heart rate. I mean, obviously, heart rate gives us some indication of aerobic fitness, and we know that guys in resting heart rate of 40 or 50 are going to be in much better aerobic shape than guys who are in the 70s or, you know, anywhere in that range. So looking at heart rate can tell you something, but heart rate variability tells you much more, because it's analyzing the rhythm or the pattern of the heart rate. And from that, we can kind of tell where the body's at in terms of either it's under stress or it's recovering from stress, and just give us an indication of autonomic function. And obviously, autonomic function is kind of how the body is able to maintain homeostasis no matter what we throw at it. It's always reacting by, you know, working sympathetically or parasympathetically, and kind of this ebb and flow balance of, you know, how it's reacting to whatever we're doing to it. And so, you know, we look at the rhythm of the heart rate through heart rate variability, and we can basically, you know, we can tell if somebody acutely under stress, or they're recovering from stress, or kind of where they're at in that homeostatic balance, because it reflects, you know, how the body's attempting to cope with what we're doing to it. And so if you're training, obviously, or you're doing something that involves a lot of stress, you want to make sure that the level of stress that you're putting on your body is not more than it can adapt to positively. It's always going to adapt. We want to adapt in positive ways, right? We want to improve performance. We want to improve fitness. We don't want to overtrain and see the opposite. So it's a gauge. It's a simple tool to kind of see how well someone's doing on an individual level. Are they pushing themselves too hard? Or, you know, do they need to push harder? Or is their body adapting and responding the way that it should? And really, it's You know, I think it's a point now where it's much easier, obviously, in my own app is through a mobile device, and you know, the system I originally had was with a $35,000 computer system to do this. It's just technology has now allowed us to do it in a much more user friendly, much more cost effective way. And I think it's going to be the future of training is going to be able to monitor these things. It's just kind of how do we make it user friendly? I mean, how do we give people data they can actually use, and we can give them real information and not just a bunch of numbers on a screen. I mean, that's the biggest challenge is taking these metrics and making them meaningful and giving people actual things that they're going to use and not just, you know, literally 100 numbers in Excel spreadsheet, because no one's going to do anything with it. That's all it is.
Right.
And, you know, it's got a lot of potential. It just has to be developed the right way. And I think we're at the point now where technology can give you so much information like you were talking about. You know, how do we actually use that becomes the biggest question. And that's, you know, obviously I've been using HRV for a long time myself, and it's taken me years to answer those questions. But now that I've spent the time doing it, and, you know, I know how to use it myself, and you know, I'm trying to get the information out there that it doesn't have to be rocket science. I mean, there are, you know, there's definitely easier ways to go about using the information, and it doesn't have to cost $35,000. It's much more affordable, and it's much more user-friendly now, and I think we're just going to continue to see kind of the evolution of data analysis, and hopefully, you know, companies will realize that the end user doesn't really care about what their heart rate variability is. They just care what it means. You know, they don't care if they're HRV score is this or that. They just care, what does this mean? Can I go push myself in the gym, or do I need to back off a little bit? Or, you know, what does this actually mean at the end of the day? You know, that's really the most important thing.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's been this ongoing question for me. And I think when we talked about this before, you know, it was kind of cool. I'm thinking like three different things. Joel sent me some of the kit for putting together this BioForce heart rate variability thing. So I'm going to start using that in my training. I've been on the road for like 7 days, so I need to get all that gear put together. But you're working on a book that supports this and explains the science in a really accessible way. And it was just kind of cool because you really made the point in there that if folks aren't ignored, you know, what I've seen is that when you provide some quantification measures, folks will focus on that, and then they'll start letting sleep and nutrition and different things go, and they'll kind of get geeked out on the technology side, but then let the some of these other really important variables kind of slide by the wayside. And I was stoked that you reiterated that it was critical that folks factor in, you know, psychological stress and adequate or inadequate sleep, adequate nutrition, adequate carbohydrate load, and stuff like that. And that if they're not factoring that into the equation, that they're really kind of shitting the bed on that stuff. So it's that was just kind of, you know, validating and you know, just good stuff to see. And it's really interesting to see where this stuff is going to go. Like my take on reading that, it was basically, you know, if you end up with a one score, then it looks like you're maybe driving the bus a little bit too hard and you need to back stuff down a little bit. If you have another score, then we know that you've probably got a little bit more capacity and you can push things a little harder. And then I guess you're just kind of overlaying that on, you know, if you've got a competitive athlete, trying to coordinate that with, okay, we've got 4 more weeks of training. This is how we're going to, you know, pull back a little bit and then push harder for a couple of weeks and then taper and then show up on game day and see how it goes. Is that kind of how you're using this stuff?
Yeah, I mean, more or less, you know, like you said, I think the biggest thing that people fail to realize is how much everything they do outside the gym affects what they're going to be able to do in the gym. And, you know, not getting a couple nights of sleep or being particularly mentally stressed about whatever the, you know, is going on in your life, or eating poorly. I mean, those things affect dramatically your ability's body, or the ability of your body to recover and adapt to the training that you're doing in the gym. And so, as much as anything else, I mean, it's an objective feedback that kind of tells you how all of this stuff is working together. It's not going to tell you, hey, you didn't sleep, that's why your score is low. It's just going to be low. It's going to just kind of tell you where you're at in that path. And you know, it's once you kind of get the hang of it, it's more about making kind of micro adjustments, I call it. It's not like I'm going to wake up one day and I'm going to completely alter everything I'm going to do based on the thing every day. It doesn't become your coach. You know, what it does is just gives you the information of kind of where you're at, and the decision-making process is still yours, but now you have some objective information to kind of work from. And, you know, really what you find is when you start to listen to the technology and you start to just use the feedback as you go, and you start to make smaller adjustments here or there. Like, you know, maybe I was going to go 100% today, but it's, you know, I'm looking a little bit fatigued. I'm looking like I'm, you know, not ready to go 100%. I'm going to back off maybe just 10-20%. You know, I'm going to cut my workout a little bit shorter than I would have. You know, once you start making kind of smaller adjustments as you go through it, you know, you find that you don't have to, you know, spend the whole week kind of recovering, because you don't really get to that point where you're, you know, to the point you need that extra rest. You're able to just kind of micromanage the process as you go through. And so it's more about making smaller adjustments. I mean, definitely there's days where I'll have to go and take a day off that they might not have taken off if they didn't use it. But for the most part, it's just making smaller adjustments. Like, okay, you know, Kim came in this morning. He's looking a little bit fatigued. You know, I was going to have him do 60 minutes of road work, but I'm going to have him do 40. Or, you know, I was going to have him do a strength and power session, but we're going to, rather than, you know, doing 5 reps, we're going to, you know, do a little bit more accessory work. It's more about just making kind of, you know, adjustments as you go along to keep them in the area that they want to be in. Because, you know, really what we find out is that magnitude of stress and kind of how accumulated stress, the body reacts differently to high loading and high magnitudes and accumulation than it does to, you know, lower loading. If you sprint every day for a week, you're going to be in a different place than if you'd walk every day for a week. And what we don't want to happen is that crash diet, you know, analogy I talked about, where you cut your calories so low that the body goes, what the hell are you doing? And this kind of preservation mechanism turns on, and now your thyroid output slows and your hormones change and you feel lethargic. And it's the body's way of fighting back to stress overload. And the same thing can happen in training. I mean, if you overload your body every single day and you're just in there killing yourself and you're not micromanaging and you're not listening to yourself, the body at some point starts to turn down that stress response completely, and you start to lose the sense of drive, you start to lose the sensitivity to those stress hormones, you start to feel lethargic, you start to get inflammation everywhere, and that's kind of the body's preservation mechanism keeping you from training more. It's the body trying to tell you, like, what the hell are you doing to me? I need to rest. I need to recover. And we don't want that to happen. We don't want your body to get to that point. We don't want that kind of preservation response to be turned on. And so the way we do that, the way we keep you from getting that point is having some monitoring of where you're at, because it's going to tell you before you ever get to that point. And, you know, I've looked at lots and lots of data of just trying to look at heart rate itself and in the morning. And really what I've seen is by the time that the heart rate alone shows a consistent trend that's going to reflect that, it's kind of too late. You've already gone down that path. It's
right.
It's much more of a lagging indicator than anything else. I mean, you might see, you know, after a week of looking at heart rate, oh shit, my last week was probably too much volume. But that was last week. You know, this gives us much more of a real-time way to manage the process and see where you're at and just kind of keep your body from being pushed kind of past that threshold, past that point where it starts to say, you know, this is too much. I'm going to shut down. I'm going to decrease my hormonal drive completely. And now I just don't have a stress response. You know, it's muted so much because that's the body's way of dealing with too much stress over time, is turning down a stress response. I mean, it makes sense that if you overload your body with stress, the body's going to do something. And what the body generally tends to do is get you to stop doing it and to turn down a response to the process. And we don't want that to happen. So, you know, it's a great way to just make sure that the overall stress, the overall load that you're putting yourself, which absolutely includes your diet, includes your sleep, includes your mental stress, includes your training stress, all those things add up because they're all forms of stress. And they all, you know, nutrition helps your body deal with stress, or it hurts your ability to deal with stress depending on, you know, how good you're doing with it. And so it just gives, you know, a way to get kind of an objective look at, you know, how is my body reacting? You know, am I getting towards that point where it's gonna start reacting like I'm overloading it, or, you know, am I doing the right things? And at the end of the day, you know, like I said, it's more about micromanaging and smaller adjustments here and there than it is, you know, the system itself is not going to train you. It's not your coach. It's just going to give you information that you can use to help you make better decisions and kind of learn your body and find out where that balance lies. I mean, how much is enough? How much is too much? And the answer for everybody is going to depend on what they're doing outside the gym just as much as it is inside the gym.
Right.
And that's really why it's an important tool.
And so, like, the, you know, the take home, if folks had a question, how is this different than, like, looking at waking heart rate or, say, like, the beginning of sleep disturbances or something like that? Looking at the heart rate variability is a way earlier indication of heading down this road of overreaching. Whereas, like, if we've waited long enough to see a legit change in waking heart rate or some things like sleep disturbance and stuff like that. Like, you've probably gone quite a ways down the overreaching road.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, I've looked at months and years of this morning heart rate, and because I have, every time we do an HRV, we obviously get a heart rate as well. And yeah, you just, by the time that you've seen a convincing enough trend in heart rate, you're probably too late. I mean, you can still obviously make adjustments, but the more real time you can get the information, you know, obviously the better you can adjust your training. And if you're having to wait a week or 10 days to really see a consistent trend, because morning heart rate, you know, it's going to be up, it's going to be down, and it doesn't always mean something. It takes a while, and you know, a really deep trained over state, well, your heart rate will actually drop, or you're getting a parasympathetic state. And a lot of people won't be able to discern the difference between a drop in heart rate from improved fitness or a drop in heart rate from, you know, a parasympathetic overworking. Yeah, right. So it becomes this much more difficult to kind of discern what that all means. I mean, you literally would have to chart in Excel every day and start to develop an algorithm to look at the trends. I mean, it's just very difficult to pull meaningful data out of there in real time, you know, whereas with HRV, it's looking at that balance between the sympathetic and the parasympathetic. It's giving you much more detail, and it's giving it to you much more kind of on the spot. I mean, you're going to see a much more dynamic picture of where you're at. You're going to be able to manage and kind of monitor and get the information that you need in a way that you can actually use it before it's too late, because obviously, you know, if you're getting ready for a fight or, you know, you have any kind of competition, you don't want to lose any time. I don't want to spend 10 days doing too much. If I can adjust it as I go, I'm not going to get to that point. And that's really why HRV is a much more, you know, powerful tool. If you want to monitor yourself, you want to use something that's going to give you the most real-time objective feedback possible, and that's what, you know, HRV definitely is a much more effective gauge than just looking at heart rate alone.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Joel, let me ask you this. Since you've been, you know, spending so much time with multiple athletes collecting all this data, have you found that you're able to make decisions on training adjustments with some degree of objectivity? And what I mean by that is you have this very objective data coming in showing you, you know, your changes in the HRV. But is your response to that still fairly subjective, i.e., we have this number here on the HRV monitor, so I'm going to just kind of reduce this, you know, training volume and intensity fairly intuitively? Or have you been able to actually develop some kind of fairly objective protocol that says, you know, if we get this number here or this degree of change, I'm going to adjust, you know, this number of percentage points in volume today, or is it still fairly intuitive for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, the human body's never going to be at the point where I'm going to say, okay, your HRV changed 8.2%, so I'm going to optimize your load by decreasing 12.4%. I mean, it'd be great if that was possible or if that, you know, worked like that, but no, it's definitely, you know, at the end of the day, there's definitely some intuition, there's some coaching that goes into it, and there's my experience of kind of, you know, looking what happened, and I did change at different volumes and just kind of finding out the right amount to decrease, and that's definitely something that has come from my using the system over time, and it's something that I'm trying to, you know, put into the book and put into the information that I include with my own product so people get it. You know, it's not, you know, it's not rocket science. I mean, literally, I recommend generally if the system shows you an orange indication, which basically means you're a bit fatigued, you're not really ready to train 100%. You know, I recommend, you know, about 20 to 30%, somewhere in that range, kind of overall decrease. You know, so like I said, maybe I was going to do 60 minutes instead I'm going to do 45 to 50 minutes, or instead of maybe doing 12 sets, I'm going to do, you know, maybe 8 to 10 sets. So it doesn't have to really be any more complicated than that. I mean, you don't have to spend time trying to calculate, okay, how many reps am I do? Okay, now how are you going to change it? I mean, it doesn't need to be, you know, so mechanical that you have to go by any exact percentages. It's more just, I'm going to overall reduce the load, and then the next day you're going to see. I mean, did that have the effect? Did I recover better, or didn't I? I mean, you're always kind of having this constant feedback so you can make adjustments and kind of learn over time how you personally respond. And a lot of times there's just so many variables at the end of the day. I mean, there's just never going to be a matter of exact, you know, calculation or exact formulas. There's definitely always going to be coaching involved and some intuition involved. And I think what it does more than anything is it gives you a tool to see, did you do the right thing? Or, you know, did you maybe do too much, or can you do more next time? It's just, the more you can learn about kind of your individual response, the more you can learn about your own body, the more you can use that information to make better adjustments, and the way you can, you know, optimize kind of your own training, because the biggest thing I'll tell you over the years is that everybody's different. I mean, I'd love it if I could train 100 people, say, in a boot camp, expect them all to get the best results. But that's just not possible, because everyone's ability, you know, to train is different, and their recovery is different, and their genetics are different, and their, you know, their diet's probably different, their mental stress levels are different, their work is different. And there's just so many variables that go into how someone responds that, you know, if I could charge $100 and train 10,000 people at once and get the best results, I would. But it's, you know, it's impossible. And
right.
You know, we really just want to have a tool to kind of gauge and learn about your body. And the funny thing is, people start using it and they tend to realize, like, oh shit, sometimes my intuition was on. You know, I felt fatigued, but, you know, I just have been ingrained to push through that. But you start to realize, you know, a lot of times we know when we're overworking, we just kind of don't listen to ourselves. Or, you know, a lot of athletes at least don't, or the military types that you're saying don't. And the more you kind of start to realize, hey, the body's telling me something, maybe I should listen to it, the more you start to make the right adjustments, and the more you start to kind of learn how the whole process works. And, you know, it's just a tool. It's not a coach. It's not meant to replace, you know, the whole process. It's just meant to give you information to use, and it takes time, and, you know, the more you use it, the better off you're going to get at it, and the more you're going to get out of it. But, you know, I think it's a much better kind of way of looking at training than just kind of having a program on paper and saying, okay, this is what I'm doing for the next 6 weeks straight.
That clears up my question. And which was really that the primary value of the HRV is the, like you said, being able to get it in real time rather than waiting for such a response. And I mean, that's, I won't argue, that's certainly has a lot of merit. Like, there, that's a really valuable tool. So that was just my confusion, is whether or not it was able to offer kind of a more objective response to that stuff rather than just the data. But that makes a lot of sense.
Absolutely.
And yeah, you know, I mean, if you were trying to do a conscious block of overreaching, then, you know, correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it's just because you're going into the orange doesn't always mean that you're going to dial back. Like, if you're trying to do a conscious block of overreaching because you're going to then do a conscious pulling back, you know, for a super compensation and stuff like that. I mean, this is... I guess what I'm getting is just a very objective data point that then you need to figure out what does it mean in the bigger context of the training.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's, you know, if you're not going to the orange and you're never really seeing yourself, you know, look like you're in a fatigue state, you're probably not doing enough. And there absolutely are times where, you know, someone's in the orange and that's part of the training, and I'm going to push through it and I'm going to load them. But what I don't want to do is push them kind of into that next level. You know, there's the difference between overreaching, where you might see some decrease in the sensitivity to stress hormones, and you might see, you know, some changes there, but there's a difference between that and an actual overtrained state. Because overreaching, I mean, a little bit of rest will restore and hopefully, you know, improve everything, and super compensation will occur. But an actual overtrained state is a much deeper, you know, level, and takes a lot longer to get out of, and it's where your injuries, they go way up, and you're in a much different state. So we want to use it to push ourselves, and really what it lets us do is know that we're pushing ourselves to that limit without kind of crossing that boundary. And we're able to control the overreaching process a lot more and make sure that we're not going past that, because, you know, we want to get the most of our athletes. You know, you want to work hard, you want to push yourself. You just don't want to get to a point where pushing yourself puts you at increased risk of injury and, you know, is pushing you towards decreases in performance rather than increases. So, absolutely. I mean, it's a much, much more real-time indicator, and you literally can take HRV measurements throughout the day, and it's funny because you can see kind of the stress of what you're doing, and you're going to see changes literally that real-time. And if you're walking around and you're stressed out because, you know, work's killing you or, you know, whatever, you're going to see this big change in HRV later in the day versus early in the day, and it's definitely a very sensitive measure to that. I mean, it's a much more real-time sensitive indicator of kind of stress and recovery than, you know, looking at heart rate alone.
Very cool. Greg, can you think of anything else we should pump Joel for while we've got him on here?
No, I was just going to ask. I'm curious if you've had any, if you know of anyone, competitive weightlifters who've put this to use other than, you know, the Soviets after they got back from space.
Well, I can tell you, I've got one right now, and a brother of a guy that's trained in my facility, he's out at the Olympic Training Center. named Mike Nicol, I believe is his last name. That's it, right?
Yeah.
And his brother is kind of the mad scientist I've been working with to help pull out some of my data, because his brother, actually, I think both of them went to MIT, but his brother,
I think
Dave.
They're both propeller heads, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. So he's my crazy mad scientist algorithm guy that's trying to help me kind of look at all this stuff and come up with new cool stuff. And anyway, he came up silly and trained a couple times while he was in town, and Dave works out of my gym with me, and so we got him the system probably, I want to say, 2 or 3 weeks ago, maybe a little bit longer, somewhere in that range. And so he's starting to collect some information with it, and so far, you know, he said he's seen a lot out of it, and he really likes it and wants to just kind of spend more time you know, with it and getting what he can get out of it. But, you know, I haven't seen a whole lot of Olympic weightlifters at the highest level using it. It's technology, you know, like I said, fortunately, the technology up until now has really been kind of constrained to the Omega Wave, which is, you know, a $35,000 system that the average weightlifter is definitely not going to have access to. Or it's been trying to pull data out of polar heart rate monitors and export to Cuvios and do all this shit that no one's going to do. So it just really hasn't reached most of the, you know, kind of average level athlete or even, you know, high level athletes in certain sports like weightlifting. But now that it's more accessible, it's easier to use, it's a hell of a lot cheaper, you know, I think we're going to start to get a lot more data out of those types of athletes and start to see some cool stuff. And I'm interested to see what Mike gets. I'd like to definitely see what the results show. And the cool thing about it is you can email the spreadsheet to me, or you can send snapshots, and we can start to see what he's doing and what his loading looks like. And I'm very curious to see exactly, you know, what it looks like to the weightlifter at that level. And it should be some interesting data, because there was a study, I don't know if you saw that, in the Strength Conditioning Research Journal, where they looked at recovery mirrors, I think it was called parasympathetic activity mirrors recovery in weightlifters, and they basically showed
that. Yeah, that was the PDF you had on your site, right?
Yeah, I think so, yeah, and they basically showed that the, you know, the recovery seen in HRV mirrored the recovery of weightlifting performance. And so, you know, I think you can use it for really any demand, any sport's going to give you information. But the more athletes we end up using it, and the more we can start to see the trends and see the averages and see the data change, the more we can start to build cool models and see cool stuff. It's exciting. I mean, I think there's a lot that can come out of it. It's just a matter of, you know, giving people the end of the day, the, you know, the information to do something with it. Because, you know, like you guys pointed out, it's only as good as your ability to use it. And numbers on a screen are only as good as your ability to change your program or improve your program with that information. And so I think that's certainly my goal with my own product. And moving forward, my goal is to just continue to improve that process and refine it to where, you know, it gives you the most objective and the most useful information possible. And you know, you know how to use it. And my thoughts then to start working with coaches myself and teaching them how to use it. And there's definitely some learning involved. The more hands-on I can get with people to show them how to use it and to teach them how to teach others how to use it, the better people will get with it. And then I think it's just kind of a matter of time before people start to realize, you know, it can make a difference in their training, and it has a lot of value. And it's just, you know, hopefully people will see that and start using it.
Yeah, well, I'm going to get in touch with you, because I'm curious to kind of look more into this, because I think weightlifting is kind of the perfect venue to getting some more data in terms of how to actually turn that information around, because it is such a heavily numbers-based game.
Like, oh, yeah.
It's very straightforward in terms of measuring volume and intensity. I mean, much, much more easily done than, you know, something like a fight.
Absolutely.
Fighter, you know, where you have all kinds of mixed mode training. So,
yeah, you know, Dave talked to Mike's coach at the Olympic Training Center, and they had, you know, basically his coach had put together some sort of kind of tracking and training spreadsheet and pro computer program, I think, we had written in Bulgaria, or I can't remember where the guy's from exactly. But
he's from Poland.
Poland, yeah. So he had some Polish program written that kind of, you know, had some markers built into it, and I'm curious how that all fits together. But they want to start plugging HRV and seeing how it all correlates as well. I think if you look at the Europeans in general, and the Russians and the Eastern Europeans, they were much more mindful of monitoring than we've ever been in this country. I mean, you can look at what's called the biochemical monitoring of training, whatever it is, by Viru. I mean, they went into ridiculous depths of monitoring their athletes. And I've been talking to Natalia Verkhoshansky quite a bit lately. She's really interesting, and she's talked about they have been able to correlate different white blood cell counts with, you know, stress and overtraining, and that was kind of a marker that they used, was was literally doing some blood work and looking at these different markers, and these that was kind of their gauge, and you know, they've got some pretty in-depth ways that they monitor their athletes. So they've been monitoring and tracking and looking at these things for years on end. But I think in the U.S. we just, you know, we haven't had kind of the same mindset, and they're over there, maybe the communism, who knows what it was, but they love tracking stuff, they love looking at numbers, and I think they've got a lot more data than we have to look at, and you know, I think the more stuff we can collect over here, the more we can start to see some stuff that has value and build from that.
Usually every place else in the world, they've done calculus by the time they exit, like, you know, grade school, so I think that might be part of the advantage, so...
over here, we just, like I said, we want to go to the gym and cross ourselves to death and kill ourselves, and that's unfortunately kind of the mentality of a lot of the training programs over here. And it's funny because if you start to look at some of the Brazilians, and we went down to Black House in L.A. when Rich was fighting Vanderlei, and a lot of Brazilians that had been in the game for a while, like they were, you know, if the average American coach walked in and watched their practices, they'd be, God, these guys are lazy, because they take a much more relaxed kind of practice approach. I mean, they don't go in and just kill themselves rolling for hours and then they're much more, they're slow, they kind of talk, they work a little bit, they talk, you know, and they just don't have the same kind of mentality that I need to go in there and roll to 100% and get everything I can get out of every practice just by going as hard as I can. And, you know, you talk a little bit, and that's just kind of their approach. You know, they say, why would I don't need to go harder than that today. I'm working on technique, or I'm doing this, or I'm doing that. They just have a little bit different mindset, and I think they do that for a reason, because they, you know, they've learned over the years that if you go and train and roll every single day as hard as you can, it's not necessarily going to make you better. And sooner or later, you're gonna pay the price. And I think other athletes, especially in Europe, are just much more mindful in general of you know, a kind of a more long term picture of training and adaptation and the long term. Way of looking at things, and we just tend to be very short-minded and, you know, results-driven, and all of our magazine covers are, you know, get 10 times results and half the work with intervals, or half the time with intervals, and, you know, the higher intensity is always the better way to go, and we've just kind of lost sight of, you know, that's great if you only have 4 weeks to train, but, you know, you've got a year, or you've got years ahead of you if you want to continue to improve in that scale. You have to look at things differently than just if you only have 4 weeks.
Right.
Totally. And, you know, it's interesting to see peeling this back to the generalist scene. This has been a theme that we've talked about a bunch, which is in, you know, putting a little bit of an evolutionary biology spin on this. I mean, obviously, we need some punctuated intensity, whether it's loading or whether it's kind of metabolic activity, you know, to drive some adaptations in those directions. But then we definitely seem wired up to need just some basic volume. I mean, almost like a factory work type stuff, you know, like swinging a sledgehammer for an hour or so, you know, where you're not trying to set a world record on anything. You're just kind of, you know, pushing forward. There's some sort of work output. And that seems to be more the base level, you know, wiring in our metabolism and our neurological system. That seems to be really beneficial for health, for performance, and but it's time intensive. But I think that we're kind of circling back around and discovering that depending on what you're up to, there's no way to there's no shortcut on that. Like, you just got to put that volume in at some point.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be nice, you know, if we could work out 5 minutes a day and get everything we need, it'd be great. But, you know, we start to look at like VEGF and some of the different signaling things, and they respond to volume. I mean, they need higher volumes. You're not going to develop kind of the basket of reactions and the VEGF stuff that gets mediated through that. You're not going to develop that in 5 or 10 minutes. I mean, it takes time to develop, and, you know, unfortunately, if you want to develop kind of the foundation and you want to improve to, you know, a certain level, you're going to have to put time in. I mean, there's no shortcut. You know, it'd be nice if you could, you know, you'd be a professional and 2 years of training, but, you know, it takes longer than that. And, you know, if you look at the talent code, the 10,000 hours, and there's no 3,000 hour shortcut if you triple the intensity of it, right? I mean, it takes time, it takes work, it takes volume, and you know, I think we have to just kind of get out of that mindset that there is a shortcut, because, you know, absolutely, you want to work hard, and no one's saying you don't want to work hard, the intensity is not important, or that you don't want to get in the gym and get after it, because you absolutely do. But I think we just have to accept that that's not the only factor involved, that there is a need for lower intensities, and you know, higher volume. If you know, it's funny if you look at like Charlie Francis was one of the better guys I think ahead of his time, and he's talked on record about, you know, literally 70 or 80% of his athlete's time was spent at very submaximal loads. I mean, he literally spent, you know, majority of his training time with his sprinters at very submaximal speeds, and yet he was able to build obviously some of the fastest athletes out there. You know, drugs aside, that they're all on drugs. You know, I think he was ahead of his time in realizing and talking publicly about, you know, the high low system of, you know, you train at 100%, you train hard, or you train in a much slower, easier, you know, low realm, and you don't want to get stuck in that middle ground. You want to avoid kind of that middle state where you're not really going hard, but you're not really going easy, because that's a great area where you're not really improving a whole lot, and you're still accumulating some fatigue. It's not kind of not the range you want to be in. And you know, I think we look at that, and there's some value in realizing that, and that, you know, a guy who is developing a 100-meter sprinter, an extremely anaerobic athlete, was spending a huge portion of his time at submaximal intensities. And, you know, we think for athletes that are doing five rounds of 5 minutes, you know, we want them to be 80% high intensity. And that's just not the way to feel about it. And eventually, I've had some discussions with some guys that have worked with Anatoly Bongachuk, who's, you know, amazing throwing coach and probably one of the better, you know, individual track coaches or skill coaches in history. And he literally would do, I've talked to him about his program. He has guys do 2 workouts a day, 6 days a week for 6 weeks. That's kind of his block loading, which is a shitload of volume, but only like 3 to 5% of it is above 90%. Everything else is in like 80% or below. It's very low intensity, very moderate intensity. Very small percentage of his lift and his overall work is very high intensity, but shit, it's twice a day, 6 days a week for 6 weeks. It's a hell of a lot of volume. And that guy has developed, you know, if you look at his coaching record, he's literally had Olympics where his athletes have finished gold, medal, silver for, you know, 2 or 3 Olympics on end. And he's had people in the world championships do the same thing in hammer throw. I mean, he's dominated the sport of hammer throw with a coach for 25, 30 years, and very little of his program is spent, you know, at that 90-plus percentile range, even though his athletes are massively anaerobic. I mean, all they're doing is throwing the hammer, which is a single max effort, you know, attempt. I mean, it's a very, very anaerobically driven sport, and even he's doing a very small kind of percentage of max effort, 100% intensity stuff. So, you know, I think if we take a step back and kind of look at the big picture, you know, we see people have been more successful than most using a much different approach than what we're trying to do with our lower level athletes. And, you know, we tend to just think that intensity is always the only way to improve. But I think there's something to be said for frequency and volume. I mean, if you're killing yourself in the gym, you can only go to the gym 2 days a week versus someone who's going lighter, but they're in the gym 5 days a week, you know, who at the end is going to improve the most.
Right. So, right. You know, Joel, this is awesome, man. I am so jazzed that we had you on here. I've got your HRV information, and so I'm going to start tinkering with that. Would you be game for coming back on in maybe 2 or 3 months and kind of looking at what we dig up with that? And maybe that'll give Greg a chance to get some information, and we could do a little analysis of what it's doing for a old dude jiu-jitsu and some Olympic weightlifting.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll be happy to get Greg's system as well. And, you know, like I said, it's just my goal is just kind of get the information out there and let people know that, you know, if you want to improve beyond couch potato status, you're going to have to individualize things a little bit, and that takes some information, and it takes a little bit smarter training approach. And, you know, I think we see across this phenomenon. To me, it's interesting because it tells me people are willing to put the work in. I mean, people are willing to show up at the gym, they're willing to train hard, they're willing to bust their ass, and really that's great. I mean, that's where it starts. But, you know, beyond that, you know, it takes more than that. It takes it takes intelligent programming. It takes some individualization. And it takes some feedback of how you are doing and what you need to be doing. And I think if we can, you know, just get the information out there to people and let them see the difference, you know, I think we can, you know, obviously make them improve their results, and they're going to see the benefit of not just running themselves head into the wall every day. And there's a better approach to training than that.
Shocker. if only that was the only variable, just like grind yourself to a nub and that'll be good. So,
well, awesome. Unfortunately, I think too many people, you know, believe that, unfortunately.
Yeah. It's
Clearly.
It's tough. You know, even the generalist programs that both Greg and I run, that intensity is kind of it's the little crack monkey that jumps on people's back, and like I think it spins some neurochemistry. Like people legit, you know, kind of get a little bit addicted to it. I think it fills a void, you know, in our lives, because we don't, you know, live that like kind of hunter gatherer gig, and we don't have danger, and we, you know, I mean, there's a bunch of stuff that goes on there, but I think that people get kind of cracked out on the intensity. You know, it's better.
Well, yeah, I think go ahead.
Oh no, go for it.
I was going to say, you know, I think of what you find is a lot of the people that are driven by that type of strength and power, just this endorphin rush, and they tend to be very kind of low dopamine driven people. They need that big dopamine spike. They need that big endorphin rush because they tend to have very low resting levels of dopamine and very high receptor affinity. So yeah, exactly. You know, you get addicted to this. You know, you need this big spike. You need this big lift. You need the rush of doing that because it drives your dopamine up. And it's funny because you see endurance athletes are almost the exact opposite. You know, the guys want to go out there and run marathons, and they want to do this just endless monotony of the same thing over and over again. They tend to be, you know, neurotransmitter-wise, very different people. And,
right.
You know, you just don't see the same kind of mentality. But then they don't care about variety. They'll literally go out and ride a bike for 50 miles an end and think it's the greatest thing in the world, whereas, you know, kind of strength and power, you know, people love CrossFit. They're the opposite. You know, they hate that monotony. They hate the kind of endless lack of variety, and they want to just go in and just spike up, you know, the dopamine and endorphins and just get everything out as fast as they can. And, you know, there's something to be said for that kind of underlying biological drive towards one type of activity or another. And sometimes it's kind of hard to steer people away from that being the best idea. But,
oh, dude, I'm a complete crack addict on that short, intense side. Like, I still have some upper forehead scarring from headbutting the bar when I was powerlifting. You know, it's like loud music, you know, some caffeine and ephedrine, and then, you know, a real heavy weight. And I know it's spinning some dopaminergic, you know, dials in my head. And it's been a process to learn how to find a life worth living without going into that like extreme overload all the time. It's kind of funny. So, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's kind of why I, you know, that's part of my own, probably kind of why I came off the road work 2.0 circuit work, because, you know, personally, I'm the same way. I mean, I benched a 380 in high school and 4-something college, and I've always been a strength, power, you know, dominant guy myself. And I hate distance work. I can't stand going out and running for miles on end. I'd rather drive it, you know, I hate running, that kind of stuff. So if I'm going to do any type of volume work, I need to have a variety in there. So, you know, I can spend 5 minutes on the ladder and 5 minutes pulling the rope and maybe 5 minutes jumping rope or 5 minutes with a sled or medicine balls. I mean, I've kind of found ways to get past my own, you know, my own
neuroses.
Yeah, exactly. And I just don't want to do it otherwise. And so if I can keep myself busy by doing some different activities, and you can put a sledgehammer in your hand, or you can put a, you know, you can put a sled behind you. It, you know, at least it feels like you're doing something a little higher intensity, even if you're not. But it's just the variety factor of not feeling like you're stuck on a bike or stuck on the road just running for miles on end, you know, is a way that I've personally found is a good way to approach kind of the lower intensity volume stuff if you're that way, because I certainly am, and you're not going to find me out there running miles on end anytime soon or probably ever.
No, me neither. Although Greg might switch it up, so.
Yeah, I'm good.
Those people love to do that. I don't know what's wrong with them, but they're out there.
Yeah, they are there. Well, you know, Joel, thank you again for coming on. If folks have not checked out the website 8 weeks out, so much amazing information on there. You've got a book by the same title, 8 weeks out. Like, whether you are a generalist strength and conditioning coach, whether you just want to, you know, improve performance, health, longevity, like, that book is absolutely phenomenal. You've got Ultimate MMA Conditioning, which is also an amazing resource. And then you've got some information popping up on the BioForce heart rate variability. So folks can get all that stuff off your website, correct?
Yeah, that's the best place to go. And just try to, you know, I post articles probably every week, and there's a discussion forum and blog posts and all the, you know, the usual stuff. But, yeah, everything is there. And you know, I'm excited to get the HRV book out there, because I think that, I mean, you've had a chance to read some of it, obviously, but I think that the more people can kind of look at training in a different way and kind of see it as, you know, all stress is going to play a role. And, you know, like I talked about in you talked about, obviously, is nutrition, sleep, and mental stress. All those things are hugely, hugely important, and you know, they affect every aspect of our lives, from our health and our wellness to, you know, to our lifting and to our performance. And we have to kind of stop and realize, you know, when you don't sleep for two or three nights, it's not always the best idea to train the same intensity that you've gotten good sleep. And those are all factors we need to take into account. And, you know, the human body is a marvel at adaptation. It's not always going to adapt in ways that you want it to if you don't give it the right reasons to. And so, you know, I'm hoping that the book is just about finished, and, you know, I'm hoping people will get as much out of it as I put into it, because it's, you know, it's probably, you know, 10 years of my work and of training athletes and using HRV and kind of understanding how the process works that have gone into the information I've put in there.
It's phenomenal. Like, the Joel sent me an advanced kind of rough draft of the book, and it was about six chapters, basically a different view of stress.
Yeah.
And it's just so valuable, because I just don't see people getting this basic education, and, you know, like the general adaptation syndrome these ideas of perturbing the homeostatic state and then allostasis and supercompensation and stuff like that. And these are just real basic ideas that have some deep physiology behind them. But if you're not overlaying, like, the intro to your book, I really enjoyed, which was basically, you know, people will throw a workout together with a certain set and rep scheme with a certain amount of mileage or whatever, and they are really not thinking about, what does this mean on the physiological level? Like, what is this activity doing on the interior? You know, we've got the exterior part, which is the activity, but what about the interior? What is that doing to the immune system? What's it doing to the hormonal system, digestion, and the neurological functioning and everything? And if you don't have just some thought about that, about what the impact of that input is, then you're just completely, you know, it's either you're following a template that you don't understand, and or you have no ability to really make course corrections, like, because you won't understand what it is that's happening. Like, overtraining, you're just, you know, you may see that in an athlete and you're like, oh, they're just a pussy, they're just giving up, they just need to push harder. That's not the case at all, you know.
Yeah, no, I think that, I get asked all the time, you know, what books should I read, or, you know, who should I, you know, what strength conditioning coaches should I go listen to? And I say, go buy Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers by Sapolsky, or go buy the book Altitudes by McEwen. I mean, I think if you're a strength coach or you're a trainer, or, you know, you work with people on any level, and you don't kind of understand the basics of stress, you know, which really all training is a form of stress. If you don't understand kind of how the body basically deals with that and how that leads to changes, you know, you're kind of missing the foundation of what training is all about. And you know, Sapolsky is a damn genius in my book, and him and McEwen and, you know, some of the stress researchers have unfortunately spent their time, you know, researching stress from a health and wellness and, you know, cardiovascular disease and diabetes type of standpoint, and they really haven't, you know, put their information out there for the strength conditioning world to use. But if we, you know, if we want to consider ourselves coaches, then we need to understand what it is at the end of the day that we're doing with our athletes or with our people. And if you don't kind of get the big picture of how homeostasis works and allostasis and kind of how the body's, you know, always driving towards keeping things within ranges, and how allostasis is always kind of adjusting this, if you don't kind of get the underlying mechanics, you know, then like I said, you're not kind of getting the overall framework that, you know, of how the body responds to training, and you're not going to have kind of the same mindset of how to approach training, and you're not going to kind of get the big picture of why these things of monitoring and managing are so important.
Yeah, we can in fact do better than the black box. Yeah, we can do way better than that.
I sure hope so.
Well, Joel, thank you so much for being on, man. I really appreciate it. We went way over, but I was kind of greedy and wanted to milk you for all we could. So thank you for being on, and let's give Greg and I some time to work with your heart rate variability stuff. And then when we get a chunk of information, maybe we can drag you back on and kind of analyze what we have going on. You can give us some pointers about what we're doing right and wrong with our training, and hopefully help this old beat up jiu-jitsu guy do a little bit better. So that would be great.
Absolutely.
Cool, man.
I appreciate having me on. And like I said, I get guys probably more often than not asking me paleo diet. And obviously you guys are doing a great job of getting your message out there, and people are listening to it, and anything I can do to come on and help, I'm more than happy to.
Thanks, man. Thank you. Huge honor having you on. I've been a huge fan of yours for a long time, so this has been something you've been a person that's been heavily requested for a long time, so I'm glad we finally got the first one knocked out.
Yeah, no, definitely. I just had someone send me an email and said, hey, they're talking about HRV over on the Kendall podcast. You might want to chime in, and I'm glad they did, because obviously it's got me on the show, and happy to be here anytime to talk to you guys.
Awesome, Joel. Well, thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
All right, thanks, Joel.
All right, take care.